Chad?
Yes?
Welcome back. I want to start off by just saying how liberating it is to take our sweet, sweet time with this.
I completely agree. In a lot of ways, I feel like, and this is just strange to say, but I do feel like a weight has been lifted, because when we started this the other day, it became very obvious that there's no way to do this in one sitting. So I guess we should just go right to chapter 5. This chapter is really all about the details, because it is just Poirot and Hastings and the other investigators talking to Mrs. Renault about what happened, her version of the story. And we get so many different details that then are really kind of the beginning of the zigging and zagging, and which one do you take seriously? The behavior of people is, if someone's telling the truth, what would the reason for not telling the truth be? And it's the beginning of a couple chapters like this, where we're getting just a lot of information about different people's takes on what happened.
It's almost like we have the facade and the setup of the physical evidence. This is something that's fun that Agatha Christie does a lot. She's like, there's a theater sometimes to telling a lie. And all these things are set up to like tell a convincing story. And if certain things don't fit, the lazier detective would be like, well, it doesn't matter. Nothing perfectly fits. And then Poirot's like, well, what if we zoom out even more? Who would be putting on this play for us? Which I think is definitely the question for so many of the books to come.
And in this specific book, then it becomes almost a few different plays within the book itself.
People are fabricating multiple different stories at once. And that's the brilliant thing, is like, how do we remember who's lying when and what the motive is? So yeah, like, So let's get into what these little mechanics are of this chapter, because it's actually pretty fun. There's a lot that goes on. The crowd of detectives, remember that there are like two detectives that don't really, they could be one person, Hote and Bex. So it's them, it's Hastings. We haven't even met Poirot's antagonist.
Yes, his nemesis.
Yeah, his nemesis. These guys are kind of like on his side. So the crowd goes upstairs. Madame Renault has woken up from her sedatives. Out of her shock. And Poirot does this lovely little thing where everybody's like going upstairs. And Poirot, little tiny Poirot with his little egg head and his little like neat clothes, is running up and down the stairs in this little zigzag. And he doesn't really tell anyone what's going on. But we learn that Poirot is testing the stairs for like creaks and groans. And he's like, these stairs are so loud. How could no one notice these two kidnappers barreling up the stairs and then taking an adult man who sounds pretty, like he sounds pretty tall and pretty broad. How could they take him downstairs with him struggling and nobody hears anything? Already, Madame Renault's story is called into question. So she retells her story, like Poirot looks at her wrists because he's like, I think I want to know if she's lying. But her wrists do have red rope marks around them. That complicates matters because he's like, well, okay, she's not totally lying. But still, she like describes the kidnappers as scoundrelly. And for some reason, that word, who in a state of shock is like, those scoundrels. It just sounds too staged.
It's not the right word. Yeah.
Yeah, there's like some artifice. She also describes their beards, and the magistrate, one of those two dudes, is like, there's too much beard here. Kind of like we said with there's too much strychnine. There's just too much beard. Something is off. Why do you keep focusing on these? She says, because we know that Monsieur Renault had these like business ties to South America. This is going to keep coming up. And South America, we can almost just think of it as like this giant red herring. She's like, they were South American and they kept demanding something about a secret. We have this, and this is the secret that was mentioned in the letter, right? Oh, there's this mysterious secret from his past. Interestingly, I noticed that, like, between the different versions, there was a little bit taken out about describing these specific men being South American, but specifically kind of noting that they're indigenous South Americans, which does, it did seem to have more of like a racist bent that was then taken out. That was in my version, but maybe not Phoebe's, but I did just want to note it. If people are reading it, we're not skipping over that.
That's fascinating. I will say that there was also one of the things that I noticed is a couple of times throughout the book when Cinderella is describing herself, she will describe herself as being of Italian descent and that she has hot blood. Yeah. And that wasn't in my book version, but it was in one of the audiobooks.
So there's a little bit of attributing certain races to certain characteristics and certain moralities. So that hasn't gone away, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's weird seeing the editorial choices, and they kind of seem all over the place.
They do. They really do. Yeah.
So someday when we have time and money, we can like talk to some of these editors and sit down and be like, why? What choices did you make? That'd be an interesting conversation.
I think I would really like to sit down and just have you say that just that way. Just why?
Yeah. So many questions. Yeah. So she's trying to explain this weird thing that her husband was found in his pajamas with an overcoat on. And Poirot brings this up later on. He's like, well, to what occasion were they going? Like, right. If they wanted to murder him and even question him, why take him out of the room? And so she says they heard something and they got spooked a little bit. But then he's like, okay. They then just brought him like a couple feet out from the house and then killed him. Again, he's trying to figure out like motive. What was the point of this? Madame Renaud claims that she's fainted after her husband is taken away. She doesn't remember or hear anything until Léonie wakes her up. Poirot asks, well, did Monsieur Renaud say anything about calling for me? It's interesting, there are these moments where she's described as acting genuine. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them where she's like, she genuinely seemed like she had no idea why Poirot was involved at all. She has no idea, like, what in Monsieur Renaud's past life in South America could bring a murder upon him. Interestingly, she also says she remembers the clock striking 2 at one point. The police produce a smashed wristwatch that was found, I think, on her husband's body. And oddly, it's 2 hours ahead of time. So Poirot's like, normally a smashed wristwatch would tell us the time of death, but something is off because the watch is 2 hours off.
Yes. And the watch is also not stopped, correct? Like, it's still working. So it's, why is it 2 hours ahead? And it's not giving us the time of death because it didn't stop.
They ask about
Jack.
We learn where Jack is. Yeah. Do you want to explain that?
When the investigators ask about where Jack, the son, is to Mrs. Renaud, she says that he's on a boat to Buenos Aires and that he is. So he's literally on his way to South America. Later on, we find out that his father demanded that he go.
Yes. Suddenly and mysteriously.
So he, in theory, doesn't know that his father has been murdered.
For some reason, when anyone says Santiago, I always have to put it in all caps because it's always said with this emphasis, like, what? He is in Santiago? In the playlist that I put on Spotify, I just went down this rabbit hole and looked for all songs named Santiago. And I listened to many. And I put some in that I thought worked for reading, but also have nothing to do with the genre or like sound of any of the other songs on the playlist.
It's amazing.
And so I was like, well, it'll be like an audio red herring. So I think there are 2 Santiagos in there. Yeah. So Santiago, while delightful in our minds in many ways, has nothing to do with anything. But it's said a lot and with emphasis. So we're going to do that too. So basically, the last thing we learn, and this is really important, is that like, even though Madame Renaud is like, she fainted, she was in shock, our little club of detectives, our international detective club, is gonna like go see the body now. Madame Renaud, you have just fainted. You do not have to identify the body today. And she like gets this resolve, and she's like, I can identify the body. And that's really important, is like her personality kind of not changes, but she musters up this strength that is a little anachronistic with what's just happened. And then Poirot, kind of after this whole exchange, he says to himself, my little idea was all wrong. Eh bien, I must start again. He was definitely kind of in the like, Madame Renaud is totally faking this, but just the inconsistencies in her behavior.
Right.
He's like, I cannot just narrate this as she is lying 100%.
Right. When Mrs. Renaud goes to see the body, she has a very visceral and real reaction.
Yeah.
And the reason that she has that reaction is because it's not supposed to be her husband.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be the drifter there that has been hit about the face a number of times to not look like her husband. And then she's supposed to freak out while her husband is escaping somewhere. Instead, when they show the body, it is actually her husband, and her reaction is completely real. And so Poirot sees the real reaction and goes, she did not murder her husband. She had nothing to do with it because of that reaction, which is somewhat right, but not yet completely.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, like we can't just like be like, cool, the book's done.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. His, oh no, I was wrong, I must start again. The thing that's so masterful and enjoyable about these chapters is that each one has a cliffhanger. Something has changed to alter our expectations about what's going to happen next.
And what we're learning. And like, because all of the stuff that we've just talked about, because this is the debrief, is not known by anyone or mentioned at this point in the book. So when Poirot says, I must start again, you're thinking,
you're like, oh God,
okay, what were you thinking in the first place? But it's a great way to like continue to the next chapter and the next part. Yeah.
Each one feels like a little short story that then is flipped, so you need to read the next one. I think it keeps the momentum up when you need it to, so that you can get through all of this huge maze of details. Chapter 6.
Wow, here we go. Chapter 6, which is called The Scene of the Crime. This is so interesting because we're 5 chapters in, we're starting chapter 6, and this is when we meet Poirot's nemesis. Giraud is the nemesis and the person who's actually in charge of the investigation.
So we've talked about there are these doubles. You know, we get the two bodies. We get two imaginary bearded men. We get two houses. We get two identities. And we get these detective doubles, but they're not twins. They're almost like Poirot through a funhouse mirror here. Poirot's reflection, but it is the cliched expectation of what a detective should be, whereas Poirot is the real deal.
He is so less memorable than Poirot. Giraud, even though he's French, his physical description of being taller and good-looking is, to me, very Sherlock Holmes.
Oh my gosh. I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah.
But the thing that's so strange about it, that Agatha Christie is British and her detective is Belgian and they're in France, but then the French detective is like Sherlock Holmes, who's British. So I just, it's just like, so maybe I'm totally wrong about that, but that was the feeling I had.
One of my writing teachers always said, if you want to write someone, change a couple really big things about them, and then they won't recognize themselves. Sometimes I think that when we're writing and we want to make a point, pure satire can sometimes cheapen it a little bit. But to have it be its own thing kind of keeps it alive, keeps it relevant. And so, like, yes, we can see shades of Sherlock Holmes in Giraud, but he's not same-same. And that makes it more interesting.
Definitely.
I think I am going to now call them the International Detective Club, because that's really what we get.
That is.
We're exactly from all right. over. We're from many countries. We're a club. We're solving this. So the whole crew goes to the scene of the crime, which is, I got shades of Halloween Party here, because they're like, we're kind of understanding the scenery, and I'm going to talk about hedges and shrubbery a lot. There is shrubbery that separates the two manors. Then there is shrubbery that goes behind them to the golf course. And then somewhere in there is the coastline. Somewhere in there is the ocean, and I do not understand it. Maybe it has to do with like height, and we're like overlooking things. There are some viewpoints as well. And so when you go through these hedges, you're kind of transported into these worlds, right?
Right.
That also has a bit of like an Alice in Wonderland feel, that you like step across a threshold and you're in a new place. So they like go through the hedges and come out at this like sea overlook.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels transformative, astonishing, magical. You're just out of this manor. Suddenly you're looking at the sea, and then you're looking at this golf course.
Right.
They see the grave immediately, and it's kind of, there's this wonderful, again, there's like this beauty and this macabre. I mean, when you were talking about the face getting smashed with a lead pipe, like, my God, that's grisly.
Right.
They see the grave, and immediately there's another body inside, and it's scary. Hastings is like, what? And then the body moves. And he's like, oh my God, it's Monsieur Giraud. And it's interesting because Hastings says it's almost like the crime has been duplicated. Okay, again, Agatha Christie's like, here you go. Here is what I'm about to do.
Right.
We will duplicate this crime. Let me spell it out for you.
Another way of looking at it, too, is that the original happened 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Now, this, we're living in is the duplication. Yeah.
God. Yeah. So many duplicates. Again, what a smart thing to do. What a cool thing to do. We cannot appreciate it until we read it a second or a third time, knowing what's going to happen. We get Giraud. We learn he's a famous detective. And immediately these two have tension. There is like this very polite, and I can imagine them both with their like respective little accents. Because like also like, what languages are we all speaking? I feel like we're all speaking French.
That's the one thing I cannot think about that, because it's like,
okay, sorry.
Hastings. No, no, not in a bad way. But then you're like, what's Hastings? Wait, so how?
Can
like,
he speak French?
Exactly. It's so great.
Okay. Yeah. So anyways, they're having their little like method off, and also like famous off. Giraud also has a mustache, but we can imagine that this mustache, and she doesn't say it, but we can just imagine his mustache is not to the style or quality that Poirot would approve of. We have to imagine that. Giraud, because he's this mirror of Poirot, he's also very famous. And he's famous enough that Hastings has heard of his reputation. Immediately, he's like, Poirot, you used to be so famous. Isn't that cool? But he's like, our methods have modernized since your heyday. And I think there is nothing you can say to insult Poirot more than to talk about method and to critique his method. Those are Poirot fighting words.
It's also so cool that in this scene, we are getting so many things that are going to show the difference between Poirot and Giraud's methods. A perfect example is finding the lead pipe. And yeah. Giraud is like, that doesn't matter. And even though Poirot doesn't know necessarily why it's there, he knows that it matters.
What ensues is what I like to call like a detective off, where they look at the scene and each one of them points at things and says what is important. So Giraud is like on the ground being his little foxhound self. He's like, these little things here and there are important. And Poirot, like you said, he sees the lead pipe, and we know now, and again, this is grisly, like Monsieur Renault planned to fake his own death by using this body that literally fell into his lap, dressing this man in his clothes, and digging a shallow grave that he knows will be found because the golf links is under construction, right? Mm-hmm. And so we know that when, I think it's like, is he talking about one of those pits that's going to be made, like the sand pits?
Bunker, yeah. Yeah.
Is that what it's called? That's what a bunker is? Because they said bunker, and I was thinking of like a military bunker, and I was like, I don't understand. Okay, yeah, so we know we're going to get a bunker, or as I say, a sandy pit.
A sand trap also is
sand trap. Okay, yeah. So he knows it's going to be dug out. He knows people will be working there, so he can be assured that within the next couple of weeks, this body will be found, hopefully with his clothes, hopefully time has passed, that he becomes somewhat unrecognizable. And he brings a lead pipe with him to literally just like smash the face so that it can never be definitively said that it's not him. Ugh. But we know that he's murdered before he gets a chance to do that. He's murdered, and then he literally like falls into the grave that he dug for himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Poirot finds this lead pipe, and he's like, I think this is important. And Giraud is like, but it's not one of these like little, and I think this is where you're so right that like Sherlock Holmes would be looking for a tiny little thing that then tells a big story. And Poirot's like, a 2-foot clue is just as important as like a 2-millimeter clue. Right. And Hastings is like, oh, Poirot, how embarrassing. Like,
yes.
you're just really trying to like get under his skin. How like puerile of you, kind of like, let's really like be mature about this. There is also a little shed next to this construction site. Is that accurate?
Yes.
We have two sheds, and I think it's important. There's the shed by the golf course, and there is a work shed by the house. I have a note that says, this is a trash shed.
Yes.
But I think what I mean by that, this is more temporary.
Yeah. Also, I would imagine some implements, like a quick way for construction workers to get tools that they need.
And Giraud is like, this trash shed is not important at all. The tool shed is important, and that's by the house. And both Hastings and Bex are like, wow, Giraud knows where things are. Maybe he is the greatest detective in the world. They are both easily impressed and easily swayed by Giraud. Also, just kind of in a funny way, in the unabridged version, Poirot goes into this huge diatribe about why he hates golf. And I love it because he's like, the entire game is not symmetrical. The one thing I can't approve of is golf tees, because they are symmetrical.
You've got a great note here too, that Giraud radiates efficiency is what you have written down. And that is so interesting within the context of this book, because all of the other members of the investigative club, other than Poirot, immediately start to side with Giraud because he's making definitive decisions based on only the things that he's seen. And he hasn't really thought about it, what they could mean psychologically with the characters that we've met. He's just looking at these things. And whereas Poirot, it's almost like, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like Agatha Christie is saying, no, it's not going to be that easy.
Yeah.
Like Poirot is the one who knows. And therefore, this is going to be incredibly complicated.
It's almost like we're given two Hastings here. We know immediately that Giraud is going to be wrong. Like, we just know. She's given us enough foreshadowing.
Right.
We know enough about who Poirot has been in styles to know that he's always going to be right.
It's like Giraud is also Hastings with detective cred.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating to Poirot that he can't have his superiority over Hastings, whereas like Poirot's always 5 or 6 steps ahead of Hastings. He's also 5 or 6 steps ahead of Giraud, but everyone listens to Giraud.
Yeah. Whereas Hastings has, people are just like, fuck off Hastings.
Right, exactly. Or just like, that's neat. You know, like, right. Exactly.
Good for you.
Good for you. Although, that's some fanfic that I would write, fuck off Hastings. That would be a heck of a
I think though that this brings up something about like Hastings and who he sides with. Mm-hmm. And I want to beg the question here. Not only are we looking at who's a good detective, but I think that there's a question here of who's a good friend. Because I think there are different points where both Poirot and Hastings betray each other. And, you know, when we go away from just the mystery, their friendship is wild.
I agree completely. Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Allegiances to each other, allegiances to the truth, and allegiances to justice. And they both pendulum back and forth, but in ways that I'm like, let's not even focus on this mystery. Are you good friends? Are you good for each other? Is this a toxic relationship?
Well, it seems like in this book, Poirot has no problem whatsoever manipulating Hastings.
Yeah.
Absolutely doesn't even give it even a second thought, just does it. And whereas Hastings, because we're also reading it from his perspective, is talking about the times that he has tried to manipulate Poirot and he's always failing. But he does also, at one point in time, physically stops Poirot from moving.
There's like a physical altercation between them.
What an interesting friendship.
I guess how they justify their deceit is really interesting. Because I think Poirot would always say, I'm deceiving you, but there's no harm done. Because I, again, see the bigger picture. Whereas, like, maybe Hastings seems a little bit more petty because he's deceiving Poirot and he doesn't see. He's, like, so in the moment in his deception.
But right. But then which is actually worse?
I know.
Like, manipulating your friend to get to the truth. I don't know if that's a friend. That's so interesting.
Yeah. Anyways, and again, like, luckily they do take a break from each other after this book. They get some space. They pursue their own dreams. There are continents between them. Okay, lastly, there is something we don't want to skip over. And this kind of falls into what Poirot is focusing on as important and what he says is the most important versus Giraud. And we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the flower beds. And I believe flower beds, even in geraniums, came up in style. So I wonder if that's like a little callback. He just doesn't buy that, like, the imaginary masked or bearded men would go through the open door. Wouldn't they try to go through a window because they'd assume that the front door was locked? He goes to the flower beds and Bex is like, well, you know, like, maybe they brushed it over because they didn't want to get their footprints in the flower beds. They find footprints and Bex is like, oh, those are just the gardeners. And Poirot says, the footprints are the most important things that they have seen all day, even if they're just the gardener's footprints. So we need to keep that in mind because it will come up later.
Are we ready for chapter 7, do we think?
I think we are prepared. We cannot be more prepared for chapter 7.
Okay. Chapter 7 is called The Mysterious Madame Dobray. We go to a new... what is this? This is the Villa...
Villa Genevieve, and we go to Villa Marguerite. And I think we've said this before that, like... I just love it. She's like, okay, in Mysterious Affair at Styles, I gave you one wealthy manor. Let me raise you by making two wealthy manors that, like, will be the scene of my mystery. It's just great.
This is very much just an extension of what happened at Genevieve with interviewing Mrs. Renault. And now we're going to the neighboring house, giant home, where Madame Dobray lives with her daughter. So this is something that you pointed out to me, and I just want you to go through it in a little introduction. The term, the mysterious Madame Dobray, is repeated, and I missed this completely, so please just go ahead and explain it.
She's always described as the mysterious Madame Dobray. There's never just Madame Dobray did X, Y, and Z. It's always the mysterious Madame Dobray. And so I don't know why, but it kind of reminded me of like a Homeric epithet where you're like, Athena will always be Pallas Athena. Penelope will always be circumspect Penelope. And like the reason why Homer did it is just so like you could memorize a million page myth. But I definitely think that we are supposed to understand that there is literally mystery surrounding her.
Right.
And it's dark. And we need to be reminded.
Every time. I mean, whereas with other people, we're just kind of figuring out that maybe they're not saying things honestly. With the mysterious Madame Dobray, it's that you don't even know what's going on. And I think that like that's so interesting that Agatha Christie is literally putting it into our brains by always calling her
the mysterious Madame Debray.
Exactly.
We do get some interesting stuff about the mysterious Madame Debray. Bex confirms that Monsieur Renaud had been giving Madame Debray quite a bit of money over the past few weeks. Specifically, we know in retrospect that it's blackmail because she knows his identity, but the detectives are still wondering if it's because of some kind of affair and her mysterious background. So the group, the International Detective Club, minus Giraud, goes to Villa Marguerite. They want to talk to Mademoiselle Debray. Hastings realizes that this is where Marthe, the girl with the anxious eyes, lives. We learn that Madame Debray has lived there for a while, but she's lived there quietly because she's so mysterious. we learn, they say that her daughter is a beautiful and good person, but men don't want to marry her because who is her father? What kind of mother does she have? And so apparently this is such a big deal that she's like tainted goods a little bit, which, I mean, what the heck is up with that?
Right. It's really twisted and so archaic, but it's also that looking at it from the perspective of like a townsperson, even though it's a horrible, horrible misogynistic thing, is it also helps to kind of create the tone of them in the town. Yeah,
exactly. And yeah, and I think that's another one of the like rules of misogyny that everybody lives by. Although even Hastings is like, Hastings actually stands up for a little bit and he's like, this is a little silly that like people treat her this way. He's like, she's done nothing wrong. And Bex says, a man is particular about his wife's antecedents. You must be particular about this. So anyways, there's just a ton of silliness around this.
That was my pickup line in college.
I find your antecedents particularly attractive, particularly respectable.
Particularly respectable, exactly. Oh, wow.
What seductive words.
Exactly. Like Aerosmith playing in the background.
Anyways, yeah. So, oh my goodness. So, of course, who opens the door but Marthe, the young goddess. And I just put hearts, hearts, hearts. Marthe welcomes them into the home. She looks really afraid. It's because she's guilty as fuck. But we meet Madame Debray, and I want to give a Hastings description of Madame Debray, because he's like, she's beautiful, but in a mature way. he says, she was not nearly so tall as her daughter, and the rounded curves of her figure had all the grace of full maturity. Her hair, again, unlike her daughter's, was dark and parted in the middle in the Madonna style. Her eyes, half hidden by the drooping lids, were blue, though they were very well preserved. She was certainly no longer young, but her charm was of the quality which is independent of age.
Wow.
Are we complimented by this? I don't know. It's confusing.
Do I think that it's better and it reflects more positively on Hastings that he's not
like, she's a hag,
or she, or the, I was going to go the other way, which is like, you know, she might as well have been a child, like, which is what he says sometimes about the women that he's
interested. Just can't. I feel like here he just like the math doesn't work out. So he has to call her mature.
This to me sounds like a man who is trying to describe a woman that he knows in his heart is attractive, but he himself is not attracted to her.
And like doing this dance of like, well, here's why. But yeah. Oh, my God. So, Hastings.
Yeah. Yeah. And apparently he's not attracted to her because she's over the age of 20.
He's not a child. She's not a child. So, yeah. So anyways, the Hastings vision of the world. What a time to be in. I guess what we can say here, and maybe to make it clear, is that Monsieur Renaud and Madame Debray both have changed their identities because of a previous, I'd say, legal and romantic entanglement that they were both in 20 years ago. There will be an entire chapter devoted to explaining this story. So we'll save it for that. But both of them were not who they said they were, which is why she can she is justifiably mysterious, but she holds information over Monsieur Renaud. She is in fact blackmailing him, which is why he is trying to fake his death to escape her clutches, basically. There's kind of an interrogation of Madame Dubray. They accuse her of being Monsieur Renaud's mistress, and she gets really angry. She's like, how dare you? I mean, yeah, and she asks them to leave. And this is what I love, because again, the International Detective Club, they leave, and this is quotes, they leave Villa Marguerite like a shamefaced pack of schoolboys. So they're like, even though she was mysterious, we took it a step too far. Right. So they feel really bad.
You needed more information from her, and instead you offended her, which is hilarious because she totally took that opportunity to shame them.
To get them
even
out.
Though she, to get them out, right? Like, she's manipulating them.
That's the thing, too, about, like, this kind of sexism through gentlemanliness. We'll get this throughout so many of her books, is that, like, women have learned how to weaponize that. Mm-hmm. So they're like, well, you have offended my feminine sensibilities. That is the rules with which you all operate. So in order to do that, I'm going to corner you and say that you've offended them and you've overstepped it, so you have to leave. So I mean, it's brilliant.
It is.
They get kicked out, but Mart runs after them. She's like, do you suspect anyone? Like, I'm just wondering. which, of course, like, is super sketch, right? And Poirot's like, don't worry. Everyone's suspicions are around Santiago.
Right.
And she's like,
there are these two guys from Santiago who apparently grabbed Mr. Renaud and killed him.
Poirot then gets into this like little teasing moment, but he also here is like looking out for Hastings a little bit. He's trying to warn him, but in like a cute joking way. Marte, she goes back home and Poirot teases. He says, is it that we are to remain here, planted here all night just because you have seen a beautiful young woman and your head is in a whirl? So he's like, hey, Sinks, snap out of
it. Snap out of it.
Yeah. But the cutest thing is like, Hastings is like, but remember after the Styles affair, you said that you and I would go hunting again. We would go hunting for love. And Poirot, we are hunting. He's like, don't you remember the promise you made to me? Which I think is such a great callback. Poirot's like, oh, my friend. He says, mon ami, do not set your heart on Marthe Dubray. She is not for you, that one. Take it from Papa Poirot. Which is so cute.
Yeah, I think it's also a little bit of an indication of their friendship that he considers himself the older, wiser person, which of course he is.
He is, yeah. And Poirot gives us and gives Hastings some really important warnings here, I think. And the thing that's so cute is, like, Hastings protests, and he's like, but the police said she was a really good person. And, like, we should know from Hastings' experience that, like, Poirot can obviously see beyond whatever the police can see.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and then Poirot, he, like, continues with his warning. He says, some of the greatest criminals I have known had the faces of angels. The malformation of the gray cells may coincide quite easily with the face of a Madonna. So he's like, beautiful people can be bad, Hastings.
Right. And I think it's also interesting that he's, like, when his, you know, catchphrase, the little gray cells, mm-hmm. he is saying that the little gray cells can also be twisted and transformed to produce evil, which is really kind of interesting for 1922.
Yeah. Yes, we've had World War One, where I feel like collectively the world's heart was like kind of broken and everybody's jaded. And we are yet to have that completely expanded and multiplied by World War II, which we haven't even gotten to yet. So it's it's an interesting, literally like psychological place that the world is in right now. But yeah, and Hastings is like, but Poirot, she's worried about her mom. That makes her a good person. And the last thing that Poirot says is he's like, my friend, as usual, you see nothing at all. Then here's that plot twist we get where Poirot says, I know I've seen Madame Dubray before. I don't remember where, but I know it was in Belgium and I know it was connected to a murder case. dun, dun, dun. And that's where we end. So again, we get this twist, like, just because we've been kicked out of their home, just because she gets really offended, does not mean that she's at any way off the hook. And in fact, her mysteriousness is now justified by this new little piece of information. We're going to take a pause here because the next chapters that we get to, if you thought things were a bit bananas now, just you wait. We have such a hilarious chapter coming that's also so morbid, so grisly. And my like subtitle for this chapter is called Pure Hastings Nonsense. The logic with which Hastings operates in the world because of his heart, because of his love, because of his unending trust in beauty and youth, takes him to some really interesting places, and we want to give it our all. So we're going to take a petite pause and we will pick back up in our next episode. What are you going to do between now and the next episode?
I'm actually going to go to this little cafe in Merlinville. I'm just going to do some reading. I think there's a hotel across the street that I might check into. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. How about you?
I am going to, because we are in Merlinville for an extended holiday, I would say, it is time to be by the pool. It is time to be in the ocean. Coming up, I know that Hastings will spend a bit of time staring out at the ocean and thinking about things, so I'm definitely going to do the same. Yeah, and I am just going to take a page out of Poirot's book and make sure that I have a lot of fun snacks.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So I think that's where I'm headed.
Okay, so yeah, so we should then meet, we'll meet up by one of the two sheds.
Uh-huh. But we won't tell each other which one. We'll just see. We'll just see if it works.
Excellent. I'm so excited to stay in France for a little while.
Okay, me too. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.